Christopher Long, and you're listening to Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 20, and I'm joined here in Sundance, Utah, by Michael Shaw, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Honors Program at Utah Valley University, and by Marina McCoy, who is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Boston College, and who also joined me for, I think, episode 6 of the Digital Dialogue, where we talked about sympathetic listening and the Protagoras. So we're gathered here at the behest of Michael Shaw, who's invited Marina and I to participate in a panel on the work of Sophocles, and particularly women in Sophocles. And so maybe as a way of beginning, Mike, if you could talk a little bit about the honors program and what led you to conceive of this panel on Sophocles' work and what you're trying to do with the honors program at UVU.
Certainly. Thank you very much. The honors program at Utah Valley University is approximately 4 years old in terms of being completely redesigned and going from a unfunded program that was run on faculty goodwill towards an actual funded program with scholarships and some housing awards and a large budget to support student learning activities. So what we're trying to do with the program is we have a one credit course that we require for freshmen. All freshmen have to take it, and sophomores take it one time, one semester in their sophomore year. And it's called Colloquium. And one of the things that it is interested in doing is building an academic community on campus. And so we have had the Colloquium students, which is about 100 of them this semester, all read the what I call the Oedipus cycle for them, of Oedipus Rex, Oedipus a colonist, and Antigone. And so we had them read it over the course of the semester. We had a discussion with the group before you guys came, and maybe a quiz to be sure that they did their work.
Keep them honest.
And they did.
That's good.
And then what we're what we've done is I've invited the two of you to come in and show them professional scholarship on the Oedipus cycle. And something that you guys did so beautifully for them today was show them work in progress and also show them how reading these plays can advance your thinking on contemporary issues. And so the real point for my purposes in this respect is to have the cohort of freshman and sophomore honor students start to develop an appreciation for the significance and importance of academic work, in this case in the humanities, but we certainly span the spectrum of academics. It's also, this is done in conjunction with a core group of courses that we have in the honors program. The first year, students have to take a course called Ancient Legacies and Modern Legacies, which are interdisciplinary primary text courses. So they've all read some Homer and some Sophocles and are well versed in at least an introductory level of
Greek. They really showed it today. I mean, they were great. They were great in the discussion, in the panel discussion, and they gave some wonderful papers. And who are the people who gave the papers today?
What we did is we had a student call for papers, and we chose from among the submissions paper, and the call was for papers regarding Sophocles and women to some extent. And we had two students who we chose to present today from the submissions. One was Kelsey Park, who is a sophomore behavioral science major, who presented a paper called Feminine Humanity, in which she worked out some themes regarding, you know, what I thought she did really well is she didn't just work out a theme regarding sort of a conception of femininity in ancient Greece. She worked out what she saw as being a divine order for a feminine role in society. And I think part of the purpose of her paper was to argue that Creon's failure to recognize that female divine order and be to some extent subservient to it, at least to an extent, led directly to his failure.
Yeah, she did a really good job of articulating that position. I thought it was a really creative reading, and she did a nice job. And we had, there was another one on Freud. And
yes, the other paper was written by a junior philosophy major named Kristen Argyle, and she presented a paper on Sophocles and Freud. And that paper was developed out of a philosophy and literature class where they were reading Sophocles and Freud, and it was written for that purpose. And I thought she did a nice job showing some of the relationships for Sophocles with contemporary and 19th and 20th century philosophy, and that was well presented to our students. I also would say I thought both students did spectacularly in the question session.
They did. They really just, did. They held their own.
Yeah. And that's a big part of what we're doing is trying to give students opportunities to get this experience, show our other students what it's like to do this and encourage them to participate in similar environments.
Right. Oh, yeah, that's important.
I really appreciate it, especially with both the papers. I was especially struck by it with the Plato and, or the Sophocles and Freud paper, the way in which they were really able to integrate different periods of philosophy together and kind of get to more fundamental issues. So, you know, she's really talking about the nature of the self and what are the forces the self has to deal with, not only in ancient times, but this more contemporary psychoanalytic view. So
it's the real value of the kind of program that you have set up there, where it's really about the this larger canon and making it relevant, continuing this kind of ongoing dialogue that we're having with the ideas that inform us. You know, so I think that's really it's really great aspect of the program.
Indeed, I also felt that the student papers opened up, especially the question session to the student papers, opened up the audience's ability to get their minds around the issues in Sophocles that we were dealing with. You know, the undergraduate level papers spoke to the undergraduate students, and that I felt actively helped them prepare that previous hour to listen and hear your papers and have already worked through in their own minds some of the core issues in the text that they might have not have solidified well. And then they were able to follow you guys to a great extent on more advanced work.
What a great segue. We've got a perfect segue to what we wanted to talk also in the podcast about what Marina and I presented at the panel, and then maybe some of the philosophical issues that, that grew out of our papers and also the papers that the students gave. So, Marina, could you just say a few words about your the paper you gave?
Yeah, so I've been working this project of vulnerability. What is it about woundedness or the capacity to be wounded that can actually be helpful to political communities? And so I was looking at how Oedipus, in Oedipus at Rex and Oedipus Colonus, first of all, can we identify some kind of flaw in him? Mm-hmm. And that, you know, although we can look for flaws and we can see that he's a little bit harsh and lacking in sensitivity to some of the people around him, that there's sort of deeper issues going on about, you know, how is he responsive or not responsive to vulnerability? So I try to say that, in fact, we want to look at Theseus as a hero, that he's someone who, through his own experience of exile and suffering, is able to welcome Oedipus as a protector of the Athenian community, and to look to him as a kind of model for how we respond to vulnerability.
Yeah, and my paper really responds directly to those kinds of issues, because I tried to track three moments of touching in Oedipus Tyrannus and Oedipus at Colonus, and was really in some ways inspired by your drawing my attention to what is Creon up to at the end of Oedipus Rex, when he gives when Oedipus asks for his daughters at the end, and he makes this gesture of kindness, really, and makes the his daughter's presence. And so I began by looking at that passage in order to try to articulate what I would call a community of compassion that emerged, and a possibility for political relation other than that of patriarchal sovereignty.
Yeah, I really liked what you said about contrasting vision and touch, and I was just wondering if you could say something about that, because it's such an interesting point.
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the things that was striking to me, thank you, was that these moments of touch when, first of all, Oedipus wants to embrace his daughters at the end of Oedipus the King, so the Oedipus the King doesn't end with this destitute, abject vision of this blinded king, but it opens with the possibility, or closes with the possibility of another kind of political relation between Oedipus and his daughters, and it's a politics that's really oriented around touch, and so I wanted to trace that into the Oedipus at Colonus, where after Creon abducts Ismene and Antigone, Theseus returns them to Oedipus, and then there's this really beautiful moment where Oedipus, the three of them hug, and there's this notion that the two of them are his supports, which is also the same Greek word for scepter. So I tried to play on the notion of the political power and the structure that might be seen in that image of Oedipus situated between Ismene and Antigone. And then I tried to show that Antigone and Ismene both display certain excellences in Oedipus at Colonus that might be we might learn from mm-hmm. in terms of thinking about what another kind of politics might look like. Mm-hmm. Antigone is attentive and responsive, and she's able to put words to the situation that are wise, and she counsels a kind of responsiveness to others. Whereas Ismene comes in as a kind of figure of feminine independence, and I thought that sort of captured a beautiful image of an independent person who comes to them precisely because she wants to deliver words of hard truths to them, but she wants to be there to comfort them. So it's all rooted in this compassionate community. And then the last moment is the moment at the end when Oedipus dies and gives the touch of the children to Theseus. And that's where I think that, you know, what you were saying about Theseus's heroic side really dovetails well with what I would want to try to argue with. In some ways, at the end of Oedipus at Colonus, what you have there is the picture or the possibility of a community that's not dominated by the logic of force that is associated with paternal politics, patriarchal politics, but something other. And you did a nice job, I thought, of talking about Theseus's characteristics. Can you just say a word or two about what you sort of teased out as the hero, as making Theseus the hero of this, of that?
Right. Yeah. So one of the interesting things is that when Oedipus first meets Theseus, he's really hesitant to share his story. So one of the things Antigone says is that words are powerful. You know, they can incite us to anger, to all kinds of different emotional experiences. And the thing that he expects is shame. He thinks right. that by telling his story, he'll be shamed. And Antigone encourages him to speak anyway. And what he gets in Theseus is this sort of warm reception that stems out of Theseus's own experience as an exile. So even though he was exiled, he doesn't take that as a kind of rejection of humanity. It actually opens up Theseus to embracing his Oedipus's own experience of being exiled. So he says to him, like, I'm only a man. I'm just a human being.
Right.
Whatever you say, you can't be a stranger to me.
Right.
And so Oedipus has had this long-standing experience of being xenos, an exile, a stranger. You know, he leaves his home behind when he's a child to try to escape his fate. Then he loses his city. He's wandering all of his life, and he finally kind of finds a home.
Right.
So I wanted to say that Theseus has a kind of sensitivity to vulnerability, to his own experience of suffering that opens him up to the possibility of community. And I also wanted to link that to the role that Theseus had as the traditional founder of Athens, who brought together the demos and all the individual communities of people into a singular polis of people living together, and say that he wants to say everyone needs to live, the strong and the weak, we live together.
Right.
And that's sort of the Sophoclean vision of those plays.
Right, and that does dovetail, and I know you might want to talk about Crossroads for a second, but the issue of the relationship of that story, and that story that you just told also about Theseus, to Athena at the end of the Oresteia founding Athens and this court of law upon the power of persuasion and the recognition of the legitimacy of the Furies and in incorporating them into the city is really part of this sort of vision of Athenian power and the possibility that something other than just about political domination.
Yeah, and one of the nice points that you made, I thought, was about how, you know, with along the themes of touch and sight, is that with sight, sometimes we can objectify. We have the gaze of one person on another, and the subject is one person, the object's the other, and then this touch is interdependent. And it made me wonder what your thoughts were on the notion of hearing, because you know, we have these examples of, like, Athena who persuades the theories, the Furies. Athena who is responsive to them in a way Apollo won't be. You know, she uses words. So, I don't know, any thoughts on how words play into this question of overcoming, you know, power that's
being... So, I want to make a distinction between force, which is about a different kind of physicality, so that this is the kind of touch that is grasping, possessive, and violent. So I'll talk about a force, a logic of force that belongs to patriarchal politics, or historically has belonged to it, and particularly rooted in also this sort of cycle of retribution. And I want to articulate a vision of power which is not reducible to force. That is, so the power of words to persuade and to transform people is critical to what I'm trying to articulate. But I think the question of how does that relate to sight and touch? Mm-hmm. So I want to say that there's something important about the reciprocal nature of touch, that you can't touch without being touched, in the way that you can see without being seen. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, is important, an important difference. But I also don't want to set up a dichotomy between touching and seeing, and then set up seeing as all evil and objectifying and violent and bad. I want to say, well, actually, in certain ways, seeing can have a reciprocal dimension too. Now, I think that brings us to the question of hearing. I mean, there's a whole long discussion we could have about the temporal dimension of hearing, and the fact that hearing happens more slowly than seeing. The speed of light is much faster than the speed of sound, and so that there's a certain kind of attentiveness and openness that you have to have with hearing.
And in fact, you know, what you're talking made me think about with trying to talk about the interdependence, the mutuality, and those images of brother to, you know, sister, which were really powerful ways of looking at this issue. I thought, you know, what we see in Socratic dialogue, which I know is something you've worked on a lot, and I worked on it in rhetoric, is this sort of mutuality of dialogue, right? So that we try to get a dialogue forth where I'm not just, you know, Gorgias, right? Classic example of a speaker who, he's the speaker, and it's almost like that gaze, right? He speaks, and everyone listens, and he's done. And, you know, I think in some ways that what we...
Well, it's epideixis, right? So this notion of epideixis, which is the showing off.
Right.
Versus dialogue, which is dynamic, responsive, reciprocal, or should be.
And there seems to be something parallel to touch in that, you know, like in that kind. So that's what I was sort of seeing, what you're saying, that speech has that potential to be mutual, interdependent, have a kind of respect rather than a kind of power mom.
But maybe what hearing gives us is, I mean, we could make a distinction between listening and hearing, right? So that you could be a good listener, or a good hearer, but you're not really listening, right? And so with hearing and listening, there's a kind of openness and a responsiveness that could work or not. So that's like Athena fails with her father and with Polynices at the end of Oedipus at Colonus, but, you know, she perhaps succeeds with Theseus. You know, how she does with us readers is a different story. I mean, it's an open question, I think.
And I think, you know, that's something we saw, like, with the students, was that sense of real conversation going on among the students, you know. So you have, I mean, I really appreciated the forum that we had.
Yeah, it was great.
You know, two student presenters, two faculty coming in from two different universities, and then this, you know, all these students present who are able to kind of have a real dialogue with us about it, where it was that mutual exchange. And, you know, I wonder if you have any thoughts about that and how dialogue functions in, like, the honors program and in philosophical education.
I think it's critical because the first thing that happens when I ask students who are freshmen who have not read tragedy before in any sophisticated kind of way, if at all, what do you think about this? And their answers are, it's sad, it's depressing, you know, sometimes pushing, why are we reading this? And what you give them is the answer to that question within that sadness. Here is the meaning. Here are the areas in which we can look at Sophocles to take away from it powerful, meaningful ways to live our lives, improve our lives, to deal with such suffering.
It's a deep-seated engagement with the human condition and what that means, with all the wonderful dimensions of that, and also the suffering, horrible dimensions of that. And so I think, I mean, it's funny when you read some of these, but even like the Oedipus at Colonus, the students might say, well, you know, this isn't really tragic. You know, he becomes a big hero.
Which they did say last Monday. Why is Oedipus at Colonus tragic? What's the plot? What's going on?
Well, I think that's the thing, is we tend to want to find some formula, into which we can fit tragedy. We want to find some mode of saying, here's what constitutes tragedy. So I respect, like, Nussbaum's work and two conflicting moral principles, but it doesn't fit with every work. If it's better with the Antigone than with Colonus. So, you know, I mean, I think I've been interested in, like, the creativity that can come with vulnerability. It doesn't always come with it. But how can vulnerability or an experience of woundedness actually be a creative thing? You know, we don't want people to suffer, but there can be a creative response to it. And you see that in some of these tragedies, that it's not all negative. There's a kind of creative initiative that comes out of this experience of suffering.
This is something I'd like to ask you about, which I think is a very difficult question because it's not well formed. But the relationship between exile and vulnerability, which seemed to me to be two critical themes in your paper.
Right.
And one, you know, the when you were speaking earlier about exile, one of the interesting things about Oedipus is he is exiled from Thebes.
Right.
And it is Creon's bad touch of trying to forcibly kidnap Antigone and Ismene that will return him from exile to his home.
Right.
But that can't happen for Oedipus, and he actually finds comfort being buried in exile in a new homeland, which seems to me to be, you know, just based on your work, to be a homeland that's able to recognize Oedipus's vulnerability and honor that and bury him for Oedipus's own needs rather than, Oedipus, we need you because the goddess said, if you're buried here, our city will be protected.
Right.
And it seems that it's Oedipus's ability it's Theseus's ability.
Theseus's hospitality.
His hospitality, his ability to have the appropriate hospitality for his daughters to rescue them from the negative forcible kidnapping.
So he does use force there. That's where I think, you know, I don't want my position to be misunderstood to say that force is inoperative. I mean, Theseus is using force in that context to take back Antigone and Ismene, return them to Oedipus, and in some ways that is also the condition for the possibility of whatever community emerges between Oedipus and his daughters, and with Athens, so that Athens itself enters into this community.
I mean, you know, it's interesting. I know one of the discussions that went on was who constitutes a citizen in Athens around the same time Sophocles was alive. So I wonder how much that's at play. I really don't know, but I wonder how much that Sophoclean reflection on where is home and who can be in this home and who can't be in this home. Who's a xenos, you know? Is the xenos like the barbarian, the person doesn't speak Greek? Is the xenos the non-Athenian? Do you have both parents be Athenian?
This is in between your papers. This is what comes out for me, is that Oedipus's exile, which is exile from his homeland, is overcome by Theseus's hospitality and community. So it actually transforms Oedipus from being an exiled stranger in Athens to being at home in Athens. And if I may push it perhaps farther than evidence allows at this moment, but where your paper goes, and I think it's a likely reading, it seems possible that Oedipus's homeland in Thebes is destroyed by Creon's forcible kidnapping, negative touching of his daughters.
Well, that and the violent war for power, for sovereign power between the sons. So it is Thebes is destroyed, and along with it, the rest of Oedipus's family, by this thirst for sovereign power, for patriarchal authority.
Right.
And so that's what makes it so. And I didn't talk about this in my paper. Something I think needs to be thought through is this: what drives Antigone at the end back to Thebes? Right? She says to Polynices, it is really destructive to wage war on your fatherland. Why are you doing this? It's destructive. Don't you see that this is making Oedipus's prophecies come true? Your inability to listen to my persuasion. And yet then, you know, at the end, even though she is sort of betrothed in this almost marriage ritual at the end to Theseus, I mean, the girls are at least entrusted to him, they immediately, or particularly Antigone, want to go back. She wants to go back to Thebes. And that's then, of course, obviously the stage for the tragedy is Antigone.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I understand where Antigone is coming from because her whole life has been one of loss, you know.
Right.
And she loses her mother, she loses her father.
Right.
And then for her not to respond to the death of her brothers is not to be herself in this fundamental way. It's to deny, even though the past is painful, to just deny her past or cut herself off from it doesn't really make sense of her own identity. But I mean, I think the hopeful thing is that with, with Theseus, he is, I think there's this element of choice that's taking place about like what constitutes home, you know, like there's this stuff about, Okay, so Oedipus doesn't... He doesn't live with his true family, right? He lives with his adoptive parents. He thinks that they're going to be the cause of his fulfilling this fate, so he leaves them.
Right.
Then he ends up with his, you know, killing his father and sleeping with his mother. That's not his true home. Then he has to leave that country.
Right.
And where he finds home is, paradoxically enough, in death.
Right.
And in... a city that he's never really belonged to before. And there's this element of choice of Theseus is again hospitality, saying we have to choose whether to live together and call one another family.
Right. Well, and there, and I think also that's where something could be made out of the site of the Grove of the Eumenides, that that he's led there. I mean, there's some way in which he finds a kind of home with Antigone in exile,
right?
Where they come become closer, and then they find themselves in this sacred Grove of the Eumenides, which really marks that moment when persuasion has succeeded in recognizing the force of the older gods, the Furies, and transforming them from angry, hateful goddesses intent on retribution and violence to something more productive of a kind of community of mutual nourishment, right? So.
And the thing is, it makes Theseus so uniquely situated to do this is because he lacked that experience of home, right? I mean, he's the one who's in exile.
So he was homeless too. He can imagine.
Right. Yeah. And so he's able to enter in. I mean, it's funny that the person who most lacks that is the person who's best situated to open up the community to have this deliberative community that's kind of self-aware and has more self-knowledge to it than... Yeah. Than the unthinking person who's like, oh, you know, I just lived in Corinth.
Or who takes their home for granted.
And at the same time, the burial place of Oedipus, by the virtue of the fact that becomes Oedipus's home in the Grove of the Eumenides, that is now, to I think a very real extent, Antigone's home.
Yeah.
And so when she must return to Thebes to deal with her brothers to whatever extent she must, she's returning to her homeland, but now is in exile. And so that, to me, this shows that Antigone is exiled in Thebes, which will account for some of her difficulties.
Right, that's good.
That's
Because that would really play well with my attempt to identify Antigone with Athena. Antigone in Oedipus at Colonus with Athena from the Oresteia, where they both try, Athena successfully, Antigone unsuccessfully, to use words to transform this anger and this desire for retribution into something politically powerful.
And Haman does that too. I mean, you pointed
Haman's
out in your talk so nicely, Haman's like this great model of what it might be to be a man. And, you know, Haman says to his father, listen, you have to care about what the people are saying.
Right.
You need to listen to them. That doesn't mean you have to blindly follow them,
right?
But you need to be like, I think when the students use that passage so beautiful about the trees that can bend in the winds that are breaking,
right. Well, I mean, that leads me actually to two things. One is, just let's imagine the possibility of a relationship between an Antigone from Oedipus at Colonus, who could use persuasion and recognize the power of words and could speak her own voice, and a Haman who appreciated those characteristics. I mean, that's a real tragedy that marriage never got to happen.
And why do you think it didn't? What do you think it is in Antigone?
Well, we were talking
about...
He's
a great guy.
Yeah,
why shouldn't he
I think he answered
it.
It's because in Oedipus at Colonus, Antigone can use persuasion and can communicate, and there's a dialogue and an openness to listening.
Yeah.
But in the play Antigone, she's done before
she's
it starts.
Yeah, she's sort
she's
of
like,
so traumatized.
Reading earlier, I'm already dead.
Yeah.
You know, early
but
on.
And this could go to the fact that Antigone's early. We were talking a little bit about that.
Yeah, and you know, we see this in the Socratic dialogues too, that the other thing that's operative is Creon doesn't want to listen.
Right.
You know, and so like there's this line that people like to talk about a lot in the Republic where Socrates is being approached and he says, well, what if I don't want to stay?
Right.
And so they'll try to persuade you. But if we can't persuade you, we'll make you.
Right.
Yeah.
You know?
If you won't listen, we'll use force.
Right.
And that is a kind of tragic reality of human life, which is we can... In politics, for example, we can try to do political negotiations through the use of sound reasoning, persuasion, But sometimes people don't want to.
Right.
And then there's nothing you can do.
Yeah,
I mean, there's other options. Right. But there's the kind of tragic element there.
I mean, in some ways you get that also with the what happens between Socrates and Callicles in the Gorgias, where Callicles just won't honestly respond. You know, so Socrates really has almost nowhere to go. And has no, I think David Rutchnik makes this point of he has no toehold to make all the sort of turning that he can that he does. But I think that's where I think the real traumatic dimensions of the violence of patriarchal politics comes into play. If we read Oedipus at Colonus as really traumatizing Antigone, she tried with words. She tried to transform her father. Her brother, they would not listen, and I feel like you're right, Michael, that she's in some ways done, and that she is traumatized by this, and therefore that closes off the possibility of another relationship with Ahiman might have been liberating, that might have been a whole new paradigm for what a male female relationship would look like.
Yeah, and I think that's that the utter powerlessness that she has in that, right? That she has at her disposal words. She's actually pretty good with
words, right?
She's sort of eloquent, and yet people don't want to listen. I think that, you know, highlights what you were saying with the two-way street.
Right.
That, you know, it's not like the rhetoricians want to say that if you're good enough with words, you can persuade other people.
Right.
Because there is the question of reciprocity. Does somebody want to listen? Right. Do they want to be responsible?
It goes to the question of thumos, too. I mean, so there you have really this root of that can be anger and can be destructive and hateful and vengeful. Or it can be a thumotic kind of drive toward engagement with the other in ways that may be more nourishing of community
rather than
the cycle of compulsive destruction.
You know, when you talk about Ismene, you know, that's sort of a good model of it. And when you described her, quote, you know, the description of her as riding in the horse with the hat.
Yeah.
I could think of a cowboy, And that's a kind of positive role of the thematic, right?
What's driving, and that's what, and Oedipus emphasized that. You came really because you longed to be with us.
Right.
And she says, I wanted to tell you myself.
Right.
Because she knows this is going to be hard to hear.
Right.
This is going to be terrible, and she wants to be there herself. So I feel like that thematic drive, or even we might even talk about it in terms of the erotic. So we've been talking on the digital dialogue a lot about the erotic dimensions of this political.
Or speech is a form of touch here too,
You
know, and that's like to say you want to say something to someone yourself, right? It's not about the content only.
Right.
It's about when, you know, if I want to say something as Manny does to somebody else myself, it's about the contact or the communication, presentness, the communication of oneself to another that's not limited to the content of what's being said.
And I think this raises a very serious problem from the first page of the Republic, for example, and the force versus persuasion dichotomy.
Right.
Because we can persuade you to do what we wish, or if you won't listen, we can use force. But that assumes that if you listen, you will agree. And the basic problem that I think that Sophocles raises in this context is, well, what if we attempt to persuade you and you disagree?
Mm.
And that's where something is at stake in the nature of a community and the nature of listening, is that we can attempt to persuade you, you can listen, we cannot see eye to eye. And then what are the options? Do we try to come to an agreement, or do we just turn immediately to force, which is if you wouldn't listen, we'd go to force anyway.
Right.
And now that you don't agree, you're basically not listening, so we'll go to force. So it seems that this question of hearing raises the possibility that force is necessarily destructive to the possibility of a community and to an open dialogue.
And that's why I also think vulnerability is important, because vulnerability means many things, right? There's the question of woundedness and stuff, but there's also the question of recognizing one's own limit, you know? And so even, let's say we have a political disagreement about something fundamentally important to both of us. I mean, if I can at least recognize that I'm a limited person and you are limited, and there's something shared between us in that limit, that can be a kind of prevention of violence.
Right.
We don't have to resolve it to stop the violence.
Persuasion, persuasion is not agreement.
No.
Or I should say that I said that backwards. Agreement is not persuasion.
Right.
Force and persuasion in the Republic are the same thing.
Right.
I will persuade you to agree, or I will force you to agree. But dialogue and hearing our persuasion with the possibility of failure.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think even, you know, you can have quote-unquote failure in dialogue and still say, I can live with that failure. Yes. And still relate to you as a person.
Right.
Because I recognize, right, something about my epistemic, moral, whatever, limitedness, right, that makes possible a community where the difference doesn't go away.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, we, Noelle McAfee and I talked on Digital Dialogue, I think it's 18, about this issue of, you know, what happens with the inability to persuade, or when we don't need to necessarily agree, but can we have a real dialogue in which there are genuine differences and those genuine differences are maintained, and yet we don't succumb to the appeal to force, to a kind of destructive kind of relationship. So, well, I really want to thank you, Michael, first of all, for inviting us to...
Yeah, thank you, Michael. It was really a great experience. Great students.
Great students. And what a beautiful location. I mean, this is just... the mountains are beautiful. And the community you've really created here with your students and with the Honors Program. And I also want to mention that we've had Alan Hill here, who's been generously serving us wine throughout the... Now I realize that the Digital Dialogue really needs an entire support staff to go with it, so we're going to have to definitely incorporate that.
But before we conclude here, let me thank both of you, because I am attempting to build the community among students with help of Alan and honor staff, as well as faculty at UVU, but it's your presence here and showing our students that what we do in our classroom extends beyond the classroom and extends into the greater academic community, and coming in and showing them the meaning of these works in innovative and creative ways really is the community, mm-hmm, that we have. So what I wish to do is thank you guys for coming and for the work you've done with them.
And one more thanks. I wanted to thank Chris Long here for, you know, including my class in this discussion we had between our two universities, combining our two classes on the Phaedrus. We had a great discussion where my students blogged along with your students, yeah, on the Phaedrus, and just the way in which this blog is made possible, you know, community across states, across universities, right, and it's just been a great experience.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate your participation in it, both of you, and I'm really just amazed at how powerful it is when you provide the opportunity for people to talk genuinely to one another. So
yeah, thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to the Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You'll find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/CPL2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of the Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for the Digital Dialogue. This has been the Digital Dialogue.